False confidence can be a real problem. Just look at Barney Fife. Take, for example, the time he got the opportunity to have some actual criminals in his cell. It wasn't just Otis, if you remember that episode. You know, that's when he gives his famous The Rock speech. You know, he tells them, here at The Rock, this is my dad always liked to tell this speech, here at The Rock, there are two major rules. Memorize them so you can say them in your sleep. First rule is, obey all rules. Secondly, do not write on the walls, as it takes a lot of work to erase writing off walls. It seems like a limited two-rule system. But so what happened, that the state police had caught two of four robbers, you know, and this was the closest jail, so they dropped the two off that they had, and then they proceeded to search for the other two, and Andy went off with them to help them search, leaving Barney to watch these criminals. So when Andy got back from the search, he shows off his new maximum security jail and his new procedures, you know, with the series of whistles he gets them from one cell to the other where their meal's waiting for them. He's really, really happy with himself, too. And these criminals, though, are figuring out that Barney's going to be helping them out. But one of them, while this is going on and the others dutifully following the directions, you know, the other leans up, why are you going along with this nutty, you know, deputy here? And he says, look, he's the key to our freedom. And so they set up their escape by having this little conversation that they deliberately want Barney listening in on. And they basically said, you know, this place is tighter than the state pen, you know, except for one thing, of course, you know, the shakedowns that they have to make sure that there's no weapons. But you can't think that there'd be a shakedown and out in the sticks like this. And right then Barney starts shouting, shakedown, shakedown, and has them leave the cell and checks for anything in their cell, and then only to look up and find out that they've walked out and left and they've escaped. So, of course, Andy gets them back, and then Barney loses them again, and, you know, that's the way the episode goes. Now, I know we don't want to be compared to Barney Fife, but he's a good example of somebody who doesn't have good self-awareness, you know. Didn't realize his limitations. He didn't see his weaknesses, which is what leads to his comical arrogance that everybody else can see through. Now that's what led to him numerous times, you know, boasting about something that he could do, only to almost within the same breath demonstrate that he's not who he was putting on to be. And that kind of braggadocio, or that kind of arrogance, is not just in comedies. You know, we laugh at that because of how accentuated it is, but you can also find that in the church. You can also find that with Christians, you know, even when we don't realize that's what we're doing. You know, we're just talking about the unfortunate unbelievers around us who we kind of quip that we just don't get it. And we're glad that we're not like that. And we might not say that, but that's kind of what we're thinking. We don't have spouses we argue with. We don't have kids that disobey. And we're glad we never get so frustrated that we blow up at work or at home. It's so wonderful that we found the Lord and that we had the good sense to trust in him, unlike these heathen around here. Can't even tell the difference between a man and a woman. They really should be listening more to us. That's the idea. Well, maybe you didn't think of, you don't think all those thoughts, maybe just at least not all at the same time, but it really is, I think, easy to read the Bible, to read the Old Testament, and to think, how in the world would people act this way? No, how could they grumble in the wilderness like that? How does Moses hit the rock twice? What's he thinking? How does David lust after Bathsheba, commit adultery with her, then collude with this general to have him murdered? That's insane. I mean, these guys are sinful. We would have done better, of course. I mean, they're really an embarrassment. Things didn't really start to look better for God's people until he let the Gentiles in. Remember, God turned away from Israel, right? And turned to us. And now the church is mostly Gentiles. And look, God's people look so much better. And maybe you haven't thought all of that before, but have you thought any of it? I think it's interesting to consider because earlier in Romans, Paul was dealing with Jewish pride. So in chapter 2, Paul's talking about Jewish people who saw themselves as superior to the Gentiles. But what Paul talks about in our passage is really a turnabout. It's been easy, actually, for Christians throughout the centuries to disregard Israel. To think, now God's turned to the Gentiles. Israel's time's over. I mean, sure, there may still be a few Jewish people in the churches, but it's basically a Gentile church. And God's done with Israel. That's a mentality. People have talked about the church replacing Israel. And some are even just embarrassed with the Old Testament in general, like the ancient teacher Marcion, or more recently Andy Stanley. You know, we should unhitch ourselves from that. So the Christians in Rome did still have some Jewish believers, but they were mostly Gentiles. And so Paul wanted them to understand what the gospel really meant. Not only for their church, but just for the subject of Israel and the church and how those two things relate. So what he goes on to talk about in chapters 14 and 15 show that they were struggling with some convictions that Jewish people had, Jewish Christians had. And apparently some of the non-Jewish people in that congregation were looking down on them and didn't care about those convictions. And so by putting everything into perspective here and better understanding what was happening with Israel and what would happen with them one day, Paul gives believers in Rome and us the kind of perspective we need so that we don't go on thinking more highly of ourselves than others. So that we understand we're at the mercy of God's grace. This passage this morning is going to keep us from thinking we've got it all put together, just like Barney, so that we don't fall on our face like Barney. Or worse, so that we, in this self-confidence, don't walk away from the only one who truly is the rock. Now, Paul does this through this analogy. And he mentions in verse 16, which says, if the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. But if the root is holy, so are the branches. So remember, we looked at this last time, and this was based on that Old Testament practice of offering your first fruits to the Lord in Numbers 15. And Paul was saying that if these first fruits were acceptable to God, then well, so is the rest of the crop, the whole lump of dough. He was saying that to say, if the patriarchs to whom the promises were first given are holy, then their descendants to whom were also given the promises are still holy to God. Paul's going to go on to say, God has not revoked his gifts and calling for Israel. But then he shifts the analogy, which is, as Tom Schreiner suggested, is because the second analogy helps us with something else. So the first analogy helped us establish this connection between the first fruits, the forefathers, the patriarchs, and the rest of the dough, Israel. To say that when it comes to God's choice in setting them apart for his purposes, that's still true for Israel. But then the second analogy helps Paul explain how Gentiles fit into this. And the first analogy couldn't really do that. So the second analogy is this olive tree. Olive trees are very common all around the Mediterranean. And plus, Israel in the Old Testament was compared to an olive tree. In Jeremiah 11:16 and Hosea 14:6. And other Jewish writers in Paul's day were making that same comparison. So Paul talks about this practice of grafting wild olive tree branches into a cultivated olive tree, which isn't normally what you do. There was a guy named Columella who lived in Paul's day who said, basically, if you have a healthy olive tree, looks healthy, but it stopped producing fruit, olives, then one of the things you can do is you can take a wild olive branch and graft it into the olive tree, and it will kind of reinvigorate it. That was his idea. Now, we don't know if Paul read Columella or not. It's clear by the end of this passage that he's not really concerned about making sure that all the details of this analogy work out, because he actually says to graft back in the branches that were removed. Nobody does that. But the point is that this is a common practice, that you would work with olive trees in this way, grafting branches in and out. So the question is, who is the root in this analogy, and who are the branches? And based on what he goes on to say in the chapter, the root refers to the patriarchs, just like the first fruits did. Paul's going to go on to say in verse 28, as regards election, they, Israel, are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. And then based on this analogy in the Old Testament even, and the idea that there are natural branches, the branches are Israel. And it's especially clear when you think about what Paul's been saying about these two groups within Israel. You have the elect and the rest who are hardened. So you have the ones who remain in the tree and the ones who are broken off. Now, the tree isn't actually mentioned, but it seems to fit with what Paul's been talking about this promised seed. Back in chapter 9, he was talking about the way that God worked and how what he's doing in the present is very similar. God's always been selective about who received or experienced his promises. And so I would say that the most general way you can think about the tree is the experience of God's promises, beginning with the patriarchs and then leading to the rest. So it's really his people. The tree represents God's people. So in this analogy, or with this analogy, Paul is addressing Gentile pride, and he gives us three reasons why Gentile branches shouldn't think they're better than Jewish branches. So he tells Gentile believers, you're not any better because you're depending on the same root they were depending on. And he adds, because your present circumstances call for fear, not arrogance. And then finally, he says, you shouldn't think you're better because these broken branches can be grafted back in, same as you. So that's what we're looking at, these three reasons Gentile believers shouldn't be arrogant toward Jewish people. And it's because of the root, because of fear, and because of regrafting. And since most of us, if not all of us here, are goyim, we are Gentiles, we should pay attention to this. This is actually written directly to us. So the first reason why Gentile branches shouldn't think they're better than Jewish branches is because of the root. So Gentile believers shouldn't be arrogant toward Jewish people because we're depending on the same root they were depending on. We know he's talking to Gentiles because of verse 13, which says, now I am speaking to you Gentiles. Makes it pretty clear. But he does something different here. In verse 13, he had this plural you, like you all, y'all. But in verse 17, he gives a singular you. So it's almost like he's talking no longer about a specific group of Gentiles, but he's talking about Gentiles in general. In verses 17 and 18, they make up this kind of long conditional sentence. This is one of those, if this is true, then that. And verse 17 is all the if part. So after he sets up this analogy with this olive tree and the holy root and the holy branches, Paul says, but if some of the branches were broken off, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, and he's going to go on to say then. But what he's doing, he's moving from just that image of a cultivated olive tree with a holy root and holy branches, and he adds this scene where a farmer has broken off some of the branches and then grafted in branches from a wild olive tree. Now, by saying some of the branches, it's clear he's not saying all of the branches were removed. So not all Israel is removed from these promises from Abraham. But some of the Gentiles are now experiencing it, which wasn't happening before. Some Gentiles are experiencing those promises too. That's not any different than what he said elsewhere in Romans 4. Elsewhere in Romans, specifically Romans 4. He mentions the promise to Abraham and his offspring comes through faith. So the promise, he says there in verse 16, rests on grace, which is the only way it could be guaranteed to all his offspring. The offspring which God promised in Genesis 17:5 would make Abraham the father of many nations, which Paul applies to right now. So by faith, Paul says Abraham is the father of us all. He makes a similar argument in Galatians 3, and That climaxes in verse 29 with, "And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise." So this is what he's describing here with Gentiles being grafted into the olive tree. By faith in Christ, we, you and I, non-Jewish people, non-Old Covenant members, are included now in the promises God made to Abraham. This is what Paul's saying. Notice, though, he says that we are grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree. So that's not replacement language. If you're familiar with the different ideas about these things, the ESV is very good in translating this "in among the others," because Paul's pointing to Jewish branches that remained, and he's talking about Gentile branches joining them. So that word "share," it's actually a noun. You could translate it "partner." Gentile and Jewish believers are now partners. They now share in the promises of the root. And Paul describes the root as nourishing. So it's providing benefits that comes with being connected to the root. Patriarchs. The benefit is the promises. Those nourishing benefits that belong to God's people. Now, I think it's important to point out that there is just one tree here. One olive tree mentioned. That tree is organically connected to the root. Literally in the analogy, but metaphorically that means that Gentiles have a legitimate connection through Christ to the patriarchs. So Paul gives us absolutely no reason to say, well, Abraham's only sort of our father. See, what is the basis by which these Jewish branches are either remaining or removed? What's the basis? It's based on their relationship with Christ now that he's come. So that's why Gentiles can be grafted in. What God was doing with Abraham and with Israel is now connected directly with what God is doing now with Jewish and Gentile believers in Christ. So here's the reality. Churches in Paul's day were mostly Gentile. So even though the olive tree, it's made up of both natural Jewish branches and grafted wild Gentile branches, Gentiles were in the majority, as they are today. And that seems to have led to this kind of thinking, where Gentiles were thinking they were better than Jewish people. And so here's where the "then" part comes into that statement. Paul says, if this is true, if this is what's happened, then, verse 18, do not be arrogant toward the branches. Which branches? The branches they were grafted in among. The Jewish branches that belonged naturally to the olive tree. Then immediately after prohibiting that arrogance, he calls them on it, basically saying, this is what you guys are doing. He continues with, if you are arrogant, remember, it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. It makes no sense for Gentiles to gloat over Jewish people. As James Dunn puts it, it's not like the tree turned upside down. They're still branches. They're not the root. They're still dependent on the root. They depend on the same patriarchs, the same forefathers that this whole plan was initiated with. So there was nothing about them as Gentiles that made them better than, more important than the Jewish people, whether or not they were removed or whether they were still brothers and sisters who remained. Gentiles were only beneficiaries of these promises by grace. And they were promises that were first made to the patriarchs and promises that were also made to the Jewish people. So there's no room for arrogance over them. We're all in the same boat. So we shouldn't be arrogant toward Jewish people because we're depending on the same root they were depending on. The second reason why Gentile branches shouldn't think they're better than Jewish branches is because of fear. Gentile branches shouldn't be arrogant toward Jewish people because our present circumstances call for fear, not arrogance. Being fearful is the opposite of arrogance. And normally we'd say, you know, you should be confident, you shouldn't be afraid. But not always. A child can be very confident around fire and get burned. especially if they've had a little success with it. So another example of that is my college roommate. I mean, he was a pretty handy guy. I've told you more than once that I'm not. And he would tell me about these things that I didn't know anything about. And he'd also share the examples of how he learned about these things. And one example comes from a bonfire where he was there. Now, somehow, and I didn't ask questions, he'd gotten hold of what he claimed was the near equivalent of Indy racing fuel. So it's pretty potent stuff. Now, he had a much better grasp of how engines work, so you would think that he would have an idea about what was going to happen. But, and he's a Hoosier. I mean, like, you know, we know about the Indy 500. If you've watched any of the Indy 500 or any Indy car racing, you know, just the fumes of that fuel are dangerous. So I don't know what he was thinking, but he said that he was going to use that fuel on the fire. But before even a drop of the fuel reached the fire, the fumes ignited and took that container right out of his hands, launched it like a rocket. So, I mean, he felt very comfortable around fire, a little too comfortable around fire. There is a sense in which you should only be handling fire if you understand how it could harm you. When you think you're invincible, you're more likely to get hurt. And evidently, Gentile believers, they were feeling pretty invincible. So Paul pictures the representative Gentile believer saying, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That I, that pronoun there, is emphasized in the Greek. So Paul doesn't deny that that's true. Starts verse 20 with a word that's translated, that is true. But he clarifies that. So it's true that branches were broken off for the purpose of grafting in wild Gentile branches. That's what he just said in the last section. The unbelieving majority of Israel were hardened so that Gentiles could experience the riches of Christ. That was true. But it would be wrong to conclude, as their emphatic I suggests, that God did this because they were more important than the Jewish people that had been excluded. And so Paul zeroes in on what was really going on in the exclusion of Gentile people and the exclusion of Jewish people and the inclusion of Gentiles. He says it all comes down to faith or the lack thereof. He says in verse 20, they were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. What brought about their removal was their lack of faith. And what allows Gentiles to remain, to stand fast, is their faith. Faith in Christ. That's what connects you to the tree. Or what means that you cannot be connected to the tree if you don't have faith. So by not believing in Christ, some of the Jewish people in Paul's day lost that connection to God's people. And by means of faith, Gentiles were now connected to Christ and to the promises of Abraham through him. Then Paul says something that I don't think very many Christians today would say, at least not in America. He says, so, you know, based on the fact that it's only by means of faith that you're grafted in and only by a lack of faith that you're broken off, do not become proud, but fear. I mean, we'd say the first part. But we have a hard time with fear. Because this fear is related to God. He says in the very next part, for if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. We emphasize love that we should have for God, which is true, and we should emphasize that, but not to the neglect of the fear of the Lord. See, it's true that perfect love casts out the fear of condemnation, like 1 John 4:18 says. But perfect love does not cast out the fear of the Lord. Paul mentions the fear of the Lord with respect to his evangelism in 2 Corinthians 5:11. He mentions the fear of God in chapter 7 of 2 Corinthians with regard to holy living. So something similar in Philippians 2:12 when he talks about working out your salvation in fear and trembling. Why? Because God is at work in you. And in Ephesians 5:20, he goes so far as to say that we submit to one another in fear of Christ. Back in Romans 3:18, he said, basically, here's what a sinner is. It's somebody who has no fear of God before their eyes. Now, there are some amazing benefits to fire, right? I mean, humans have figured out how to use fire effectively in a lot of different ways. But the best way to handle fire is with an understanding of how it can harm you if you misuse it. So in a similar way, we have this loving relationship with God the Father, with the Lord Jesus, with the Holy Spirit, and that calls for a fear that recognizes that God has great power and he is a holy God, and you do not misuse that relationship. That's what Paul's reminding the Gentile believers and us today. There is nothing good in us. We're sinners who deserve nothing but God's wrath. It was God's great mercy and grace that anyone, Jew or Gentile, has experienced a relationship with him. And it's our connection with God that has these amazing, wonderful blessings that flow from it, but only belongs to us by faith. There's nothing special about us individually as a people. God's not saving us because he saw something in us. He's not treating us differently than those he hardened in Israel because of who we are. There's nothing special about us. Paul likes to say that. Goes so far as in 1 Corinthians to say, you know, Christians, you're not really that wise or powerful or noble. And God chose the weak and the despised, he says, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And what that means that is that the only reality keeping us in this relationship is faith. And were that not true, we'd be just as lost as the majority of Israel. And Paul then gives us one more look at our circumstances. He says in verse 22, note then the kindness and severity of God. Severity towards those who have fallen, but kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. It's good for us to see God's kindness. But it's also good for us to see his severity. So this kindness and severity have to do with what God has done with the Gentile believers and what he's done with the majority of Israel who have fallen. Last week, I mentioned that God's intention with Israel stumbling was not to fall. There he's talking about Israel as a nation. He didn't intend them to fall as a nation, but there were some in Israel who did fall. They were severed from those promises. And that's really what severity seems to be related to. Being cut off. In the Greek word, in, we could probably make a connection there in English. The term kindness reminds us that what we experience isn't deserved. God doesn't owe us salvation. There's no synergism in salvation. It's not like God's done his part and now we do our part by applying and accepting what Jesus has done for us. That's some sort of a transaction. I know that is what we hear. But that is not what it means to believe. That's not what faith is. I know we've heard the scenario before. Well, God is offering you a gift, but you have to accept it. Is that what faith is? Accepting a gift. Is that what faith is? Where would we get that idea? The term received, right? But in John, who uses that idea, he's not talking about taking something. He's talking about acknowledging something. Acknowledging that Jesus is the Messiah. It's just a synonym for belief. It involves hearing the good news that Jesus is the crucified and risen Lord and believing it, but not just believing it in some impersonal or dispassionate way. Saving faith means that you believe this good news about Jesus in a way that changes your life. Imagine a homeless person. A homeless guy who lives day to day on what people give him. And imagine that person finds out that they are actually the heir of a kingdom. If that person really believed that news, it would change his life. I mean, if that person, they could say, oh, I believe it, and then keep living on the street. But do they really believe it? No, if they really believed it, they would pursue that inheritance. They'd act on that belief. That life that they had would change dramatically. And they'd begin to experience the benefits of that inheritance because they believed. And that's what faith is like. When you believe that Jesus is the divine Lord who humbly came here, lived the life you should have lived, then died to pay the punishment you deserve, to rescue you from your sinful life, to forgive your sin, to reunite you with God. When you really believe that, with saving faith, then your life is changed forever. You can't look at your life the same way anymore. That's what makes the difference. That's what connects you with the riches of Christ, the belief that you have a relationship with Christ. So do you know those riches? Do you believe Jesus died and rose again for you? And has that changed your life? Does that change the way that you think about who you are? Does that change the way you think about who God is to you? Does that change the way that you live your life? And if you have questions about that, please talk to me afterwards. Notice, though, that Paul makes a qualification here. He tells this representative Gentile believer, God's kindness is to you provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. And I think this works on two levels. So on the one hand, Paul's talking about a salvation historical reality. He's talking about the decisive moment when the old covenant transitioned to the new covenant. And at that point, the majority of Israel was severed from God's covenant people, and Gentiles were grafted into that people. Paul's talking to Gentile believers through this representative of Gentiles and Gentile believers. And so he tells the Gentiles, again, there's nothing particularly special about you compared with these Jewish people who have been removed. He's basically telling them, look, God could do the same thing to Gentiles that he's done to this part of Israel. Same thing could happen to you. It's hypothetically possible that God could cease to show Gentiles kindness. And like the majority of Israel, they would be cut off from the olive tree of his people. So in a way, this is what happens. It's what Paul goes on to talk about. He's going to go on to talk about the fullness of the Gentiles coming in. And when that happens, then God turns back to his old covenant people and all Israel will be saved. That's the order that Paul just continually talks about here. For now, there's a remnant of Israel and primarily Gentiles that are being saved. But when this mission to the Gentiles, as Mark Seifried puts it, when that mission comes to an end, Israel is grafted back in as a whole to the new covenant people of God. So this is a warning, in some sense, I think, of timing. Gentile believers should not presume on God. They are the beneficiaries of his kindness right now, but that could change. There could be a limit to the timing of that kindness. There is going to be a limit to that kindness. And when the last Gentile believer comes to faith, God is going to turn to Israel and save the nation in his final climactic act before the end. But I do think this also works on another level. It does warn any believer in the present that God's kindness toward them is only true so long as they believe. Saving faith is a faith that perseveres. So you only stand fast in God's kindness by faith. Now, I am not saying that any genuine believer can lose their salvation. Notice Paul's not talking about election here. He doesn't actually use that language. And I know you could try to make that connection. You could try to bring that back in. But just understand the analogy. In the analogy, what's going to happen is the very same branches that were broken off are going to be grafted back in. So is Paul saying that, well, okay, so the people in Israel who didn't believe in Jesus when he died, they're the ones that in the end are going to be grafted back in, those first century Jewish people. See, the analogy doesn't work if we work at it at simply an individualistic way. But it is stressing the fact that you're part of God's people by faith. So you could understand that the Bible does talk about, there are passages that talk about people who believed at one time and walk away. Numerous places in the New Testament mention that. But there aren't actually any passages in the Bible that talk about losing your justification or losing your new birth. Not a one. So the Bible talks on two levels here. It describes the situation from the standpoint of our experience, our believing or not believing, and from the standpoint of what God is doing. So when God brings about saving faith by that good news and by his Spirit, he begins a work that he will finish. But we don't always know whether our faith is actually the result of new birth or whether we're just convinced in a human way, by human means and methods, which we could stop believing. So what do you do then? I mean, that could be a scary thought, right? That actually is where fear comes into play, but not the fear of condemnation. What comes into play is that you don't treat God in a mechanistic way, as though you have God under control. As though I did my part, now God has to uphold his part. And then I can just do whatever I want. We recognize that God is God, and we are not. And so we listen to him. We seek him as he's directed us to seek him. We gather with his people and experience the ordinances that Jesus gave to the churches. We pursue him with daily communion that meditates on his word and depends on him in prayer. We experience the Spirit's sanctifying work through one another. We've been brought into a body that the Spirit is at work through us, helping each other become more like Christ. So we don't neglect that. And in none of that are we arrogant, as we fearfully recognize the glory, the power, the holiness of God. We're not arrogant about our situation. Arrogance doesn't move you closer to God. It sends you in the other direction. It makes you self-reliant and think that you're fine and you don't need these things. We need to come to church. We don't need the ordinances. We don't need our Bible. We don't need to pray. That's what arrogance does. But a reverential fear of the Lord that also includes a love for him. So I'm not going to mistreat this relationship. I'm going to do what you ask, what you tell us to do. The third and final reason in this passage why Gentile branches shouldn't think they're any better than Jewish branches is because of regrafting. So Gentile believers shouldn't be arrogant towards Jewish people because Jewish people can be grafted back in, same as us. Paul comes back to what kind of sounds like this hypothetical situation, but it relates to what God is doing in salvation history. And he says in verse 23, "And even they, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again." If unbelief is the means that they're disconnected, then if they don't continue in that state, they'd be grafted back in. If they believe, by means of that faith, they would once again be connected to God's people. And Paul says very plainly, God can do that. And then he explains why in verse 24. He says, "For if you were cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these, the natural branches, be grafted back into their own olive tree?" It comes back to this analogy that if God can take what is contrary to nature and graft it into the olive tree that he's cultivated, then why in the world couldn't he take what is according to nature or natural and graft them back in? And if he can take what doesn't belong and fit it into this tree, how much more is it reasonable that he could take what does fit and make it belong to the tree? So in other words, if God's plan, if in his plan he has set Israel apart to experience the promises that were originally given to the patriarchs, the root of this tree, it makes sense that he's going to bring them back in. He's going to bring them back into that tree to enjoy those promises. I mean, he's already taken people who had no connection to his promises and brought them into it to experience them. So bringing Israel back in actually makes more sense than what he's done with us. And that's the order you see in this passage. Dr. Moo pointed out that in Romans 11, 11, and 12, he talks about this kind of sequence. You have Israel's trespass, then salvation for the Gentiles, and then finally Israel's fullness or full inclusion. In verse 15, he talks about the rejection of the majority of Israel, then reconciliation for the world, and then final acceptance of Israel. And in a little bit, in verses 25 and 26, he's going to talk about the partial hardening of Israel, the fullness of the Gentiles coming in, and then all Israel being saved. This is the order. First, Israel has been hardened so that the Gentiles can come in, but Israel is going to be brought back in as a nation and saved. But it's, again, good to point out that there is nothing in these verses that suggests that God has two programs. One with Israel and one with the church. I mean, look at verse 24. This is when God turns back to Israel. It says that they will be grafted back into their own olive tree. And who is currently in their own olive tree? Gentiles. Along with those Jewish people that remain. So there's nothing ever in the New Testament that suggests that national Israel is going to experience something that's uniquely different than what the Jewish people in the church are currently experiencing. That their experience is not going to be connected to Christ and the promises that are ours in him. Nothing in the New Testament suggests that. We, the church, could be called the New Covenant people of God. This is the people Christ inaugurated with his death, which during the first communion, the Last Supper, he talked about his sacrificial death as the new covenant in my blood. We are thoroughly, completely, fully connected to the climax of the covenants, which is the new covenant. Paul already said Gentile believers now share in the richness that came from the patriarchal root. So, again, Abraham is every bit our father as any Jewish person in terms of his promises. We are Abraham's offspring, fellow heirs with the Old Testament saints. That's how Paul puts it in Galatians and Ephesians. There's one people of God. Through Christ, it includes now a remnant of Israel and Gentiles. One day, though, all Israel is going to experience God's promises, be grafted back in to the new covenant people of God by union with Christ, by faith. Same as us goyim, us Gentiles. If we continue in faith. So one of the ways that we encourage one another to continue in faith is through communion. That's what we're doing. Through the Lord's Supper. So we've been saying how the reality of faith, that's what determines whether you're part of the group or not. And that's connected to the idea that it's only members of the church that participate in communion. So these practices, we just saw the other ordinance last week, baptism, and this ordinance this week, both of them are portraying faith. And so these reflections of faith, Christ gave the church, churches, local churches, the authority to regulate these ordinances. That's where they take place. They should not take place outside of the church. So this is a matter of accountability. This is what Christ was setting up through these things. That's really what this in large part involves is accountability. So if there's an individual in our church who shows evidence of being an unbeliever. Previously, we thought they were a believer, but they show evidence of being an unbeliever. After we lovingly confront them, if they confirm their unbelief, they should not participate in what portrays somebody's faith. And that's what the local church does. They provide accountability. And through this Lord's table, that person would be excluded from the table. So that's what the ordinances do. They provide accountability. We could say it this way. Through baptism, we're affirming a person's faith and bringing them into our community where we can hold them accountable. And then through communion, we continue to confirm that faith. So through baptism, it's like we are issuing passports. And then every time we have communion, it's like we are stamping the passport. So the church does not give somebody their citizenship in heaven. Christ does that. But Christ gave the church authority to authenticate true faith. And we do that through baptism and through the Lord's Supper. So that's why this is a church family practice. But we do allow visitors to join with us, provided that you are a baptized member of a church that believes the same gospel that we believe and preach. And if that's true, you can join us. If that's not true, I would encourage you to let the elements pass. And I would also encourage you to talk to me afterwards if you would like to join with us and be a part of this. So would the men come forward to administer the Lord's Supper?